Impressions with Jimmy Akin.
Hey there.
Hi, Jimmy.
Welcome back.
Welcome back. Thank you. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, enjoying the special music we have for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. That signals that the fun is about to start. We have had submitted to us through the various means, social media, email, and whatnot, various weird questions.
I like that sort of Spanish pronunciation you did there.
Of which?
Of the word special.
What did I say?
Especial.
Especial.
Because, you know, in Spanish, you can't have the letter S on the front of a word. It takes a vowel before it.
I totally never noticed that.
Mm-hmm. School is escuela.
Oh, yeah. And especial. Let's see what else. Well, that's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Star is estrella.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to start. Well, let's go to the questions.
Okay.
These are weird. These are weird questions for Jimmy. He loves some weird questions, so much so that whenever, I think I've told you this before, whenever we get a really weird question and someone else is on, they always say, oh, that's a Jimmy Akin question.
Oh,
so
okay.
You have a rep. AD asks this, if a human is a rational animal,
yes,
that is to say that the natural tendency to grow, eat, feel, see, will, and reason, it has those, then would the consecrated Eucharist have these innate tendencies as well? Are there any conditions under which the Eucharist can do even one of these things mentioned, let alone all of them?
So the answer is that Jesus is a man. He has a complete human nature. He's also God, but he's fully human, fully divine. So he has, he fits the definition in his human nature of a rational animal, and he has all those tendencies. The Eucharist is a manifestation of Jesus, but you can't reason across categories in the same way. For example, I'm also a rational animal.
Yeah.
But if I'm manifesting in some way, let's say I'm on Facebook, it doesn't mean, you know, with a live streaming, it doesn't mean that my image has all of the same properties that I have.
Right.
And so if you conceptualize the Eucharist as a manifestation of Jesus, you're not going to find the host and the accidents there doing the things that Jesus would do in his physical body. So Jesus in his physical body might raise his hand, but he's not present in the Eucharist in such a way that his body is distributed in the same way that it is in heaven. And theologians refer to the type of presence that he has as definitive presence in the Eucharist, which means that he's there and he fills the Eucharist in the same way that our souls fill our bodies. They're not located in just one part of the body. And so if Jesus raises his hand in heaven, that's not going to result in any outward change in the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
So you could conceptualize it different ways, but fundamentally we have two different aspects going on here. The first is the reality, which is Jesus' body, blood, soul, and divinity. And that's present in heaven in a way that could, you know, he could raise his hand or blink his eyes or do any of these other things. But then we have the perceptible accidents or species of bread and wine that remain, and those are not affected by whatever Jesus may do with his body in heaven.
AD, thank you very, very much for that question. Next, we go to Michael. On the most recent episode of Weird Questions, several questions came up that led to alternative timelines. This raised a couple of questions for me. By time traveling, are you interfering with God's plan? Even if we think we are stopping an evil act, God has his reasons.
Okay, and let's do one that one first.
Okay.
So the answer will be no. The specific form of the answer will depend on what happens with time travel. Either it is possible to change history or it's not. You know, either you go back and there's it's been called a chronology protection principle, where no matter what you do, you cannot stop John Kennedy from being assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
You may try to stop Lee Harvey Oswald, but you will, or whoever it was, but you will always fail. The alternative is if you are able to change history, what you're really doing, the easiest way to make sense of that in terms of physics, is what you're really doing is creating a new branch in the timeline. So one or the other is the likely outcome of time travel. If it's the first, then obviously you're not interfering with God's plan because you can't change what happened. On the other hand, if you create a branching timeline, which is what he's asking about, then that branching timeline is also part of God's plan. It was God's plan to have one timeline where Kennedy dies, and it was God's plan to have another timeline where Kennedy doesn't die, and you simply helped actualize that second timeline. So you were part of God's plan in what you did, because however many timelines there are, there aren't any that God doesn't include in his plan.
All right, so the second part, if you were to save someone in the past, would that person in the new timeline have a different soul? They lived a longer lifetime and committed other acts, either righteous or sinful. To me, that would logically mean it's not the same soul, since we are judged by our one life. One version of the person could have gone to hell and the other to heaven.
So this is something I've actually thought about for more than a decade. And I meant to write about it a long time ago on my blog, and I haven't done that to date. But here's the answer. So if timelines branch, then souls do too. And the question is, because you'll have two different versions, one where Kennedy dies and one where Kennedy keeps on living and goes on to commit new acts, either righteous or unrighteous. So in both of those timelines, at some point, Kennedy is going to die and stand before God. And since both timelines are equally real, both versions of Kennedy will be standing before God. So if timelines branch, souls branch. The question is, how do you then conceptualize this? Do you conceptualize this such that as the soul branches, it's all still part of one thing? You know, kind of like a succulent plant or something that has little different branches coming off of it, like kind of a needleless cactus or something? If that's the case, then what gets judged is each little end of the cactus, or each little end of a branch, where the person dies and stands before God. On the other hand, you could say, well, no, this is like a quantum phenomenon, like where, say, a photon splits in two, and you now have two separate photons, and each one is now viewed independently, regardless of their history. But if timelines branch, souls branch. It's just a question of there, how do you want to conceptualize that? Do you want to conceptualize the soul as the whole thing with these different branches that then get judged or sent to heaven or hell? Or do you want to conceptualize each little branch and say, okay, that's the soul, in which case it's judged on what it has done in its timeline?
Thanks very much. That's definitely qualifies. That was Michelle, actually. I think I said Michael. Michelle, thank you very much. That's definitely a weird question, and we appreciate it. It's Weird Questions this hour with Jimmy Akin. We got a whole bunch of them collected, more coming up right after the break. And before I send you to the break, I want to share with you some of the stuff we're doing on the podcasts right now, so you can check them out over at the Council of Trent. Should Catholics Believe in the Rapture? That's a recent episode. How Anyone Can Fight for Life? That's an interview that he did with Lila Rose. Over at Focus, we've got some kind of controversial ones for you to check out. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Catholic Faith is one of them. And the other one is The Unchristian Roots of STEM Education. Check them out at our podcast page or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Catholic Answers Focus and the Council of Trent.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, and we got a whole bunch of weird questions up next. This one comes from Scooby. Given the speed of light, is given the speed of light, is it possible that a person right now on a planet 2,000 light years away and with a telescope so powerful that he could see onto the surface of the Earth in great detail could watch Jesus walking and teaching?
Yes. Yeah, it is possible. The trick would be, how do you get a telescope that big? Because
yeah, that'd be incredible resolution.
Yeah, because the density of the light decreases according to the cube square law, which means as you get further and further away from Earth, the light gets rapidly thinner and thinner. And so in order to capture enough photons to get a picture of Jesus walking and talking, you're going to need, I haven't done the math, but you're going to need an enormous telescope, probably one that would span light years.
Yeah.
And so you could either build such a telescope, or you could do something that not a lot of people are familiar with, but you could link several different telescopes widely separated from each other and connect them together and coordinate the light coming in from them. This is a process in astronomy known as aperture synthesis, mm-hmm. where you synthesize a new aperture from the different ones of these different telescopes. And so we can create here on Earth, Earth-sized telescopes by linking satellites on telescopes, some of which may be on satellites, on different sides of the Earth. So you can actually get pretty big telescopes through aperture synthesis, but somehow you're going to need to get a telescope big enough to form an image of Jesus based on the individual photons that you're receiving as they spread out over the course of 2,000 years. You're also going to have to correct for things like gas and dust clouds and stars and other bodies that are in the way that can interfere with that light.
A very interesting question, Scooby. Thanks very much. I would not recommend, however, traveling 2,000 light years away and trying it, because by the time you get there, it's not going to work. Patrick has the following question.
You need to go maybe 4,000 light years or something.
If you travel there at the speed of light, it would take you 4,000 years to get there.
You could.
Oh, no, that wouldn't. Right. Mm-hmm. Wait.
I'm assuming faster than light.
Yeah, you'd have to go faster than light. Yeah. Patrick asks, will every curiosity or question that I have in this life have an answer in heaven? Or will the experience of sanctification or purgatory simply remove that curious or questioning spirit from me?
So what purgatory does is free us from disordered attachments, not from ordered ones. And as a result, if we have a disordered curiosity about an issue, we'll be cured of the disorder. But if we have an ordered curiosity, if it's reasonable for us to wonder about something, then we won't be cured of it because it's not disordered. And so we'll still have curiosities about things. And the catechism envisions us, certainly the Christian faith does not envision us just becoming like uncurious zombies.
Yeah.
In fact, the catechism itself in the section on the problem of evil talks about how, you know, we won't know in this life what some of the answers are. to like why God allowed this particular evil or that particular evil, but it has an expectation that we will know those things in the next life. So it can be reasonable, like, Lord, why did this happen to me? Well, in the next life, the catechism would expect you to be able to find that out. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect, because, you know, we're told the next life is much better, that we're going to have an intellectual upgrade as part of the package, and we'll know more rather than less, and we'll consequently, when we learn the answers to these mysteries, we will be able to praise God even more and see how they all fit together as part of his plan.
I'm guessing that that's what, probably where you thought that was going to go, Patrick, but I don't know. I think that comes from our friend Patrick in New York, who we'll see in a few weeks at the conference. Looking forward to seeing you, Patrick. Let's go to Jill. She says this, Jimmy, or she asked this. What is your take on the floating log mat model for the origin of coal beds and biogeography? As a coal miner and a Catholic, I am interested in the theory that the Great Flood caused a mass or masses of fallen logs to float about the world. But I have a hard time making the leap that this proves a young Earth, and our previous theories for the formation of coal seams taking millions of years are no longer valid. On a related note, is the story of the Great Flood required to be taken literally, or could it have been a regional flood that wiped out the human population but maybe did not cover the entire Earth?
So let's deal with the second question first. Currently, the answer is that the Great Flood is not required to be understood as a global flood. Even if you take the flood as a literal historical event, it does not require a global flood. And as I'll discuss on an upcoming episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, we do not have good evidence of a global flood. The arguments that are used by young earthers are interesting, but to deal with the first question, well, it's possible that that floating log mats, you know, mats made out of logs that have been knocked down, such as by a flood, mm-hmm. Could give rise to a coal bed, given enough time. The issue, though, and I would assume that that's actually happened in, you know, in history at some point, that there have been some log mats. I mean, we know that happens you know, when there's a flood, if the flood's big enough. And I would assume some of them over millions of years have turned into coal. But the problem for a young Earth perspective is stratigraphy, because the layers in the soil do not support the idea of a universal flood. And this was one of the findings. Now, for a time in the 1600s and 1700s, there was a very interesting development in science, which was called flood geology. Mm-hmm. And because they were starting to discover, they're starting to, you know, dig down and find new layers and things like that. And initially, scientists experimented with this idea of flood geology, then that's the explanation for all the different layers we see. But what they found is that it ends up not working because the layers don't fit together the right way.
Ah, gotcha.
And to keep it simple, they just don't fit together the right way. And so they had to abandon that and realize that the Earth is much, much older. And that's something that I discuss in a three-part series on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which Jill can look up, and it has an explosive finale where I reveal why, what would have happened if there was a young Earth with a global flood, and it involves lots and lots of explosions. I mean, like hypernuclear explosions, if Earth really was you know, just a few thousand years old, and there had been a year of a flood the way young Earth creationists envisioned it, in order to account for all the rock formations, those rocks would have had to release so much radiation that the surface of the Earth would have melted. And then you say, well, what if God did a miracle to keep it from melting? Well, listen to the episodes and find out.
Hey, Jill, thanks for that question. Thanks very much. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Mike next. Mike asks this, Jimmy, before I became Catholic, I enjoyed those shows on Travel Channel like Ghost Adventures, where these paranormal investigators would lock themselves in a haunted place to try to capture evidence of the paranormal through EVP, that is electronic voice phenomena, sessions and whatnot. I don't necessarily believe it was all real or all fake for that matter either, and I'm a fairly educated individual and understand the behavioral psychology of hearing voices through EVP and as such am highly skeptical. However, these shows are very entertaining, and I have to admit I enjoy them for entertainment. As a Catholic, is it a sin to watch these shows for entertainment? And there's a little bit more. I would never even think of doing it myself or even put any stock in what they do. I know we are forbidden from attempting to contact the dead, but is watching these shows for entertainment per se sinful? I can't find anything definitive about it.
So I would be a little less definitive on one of the latter points he mentioned. I mean, if you're in a situation, we're forbidden to conjure up the dead and, you know, try to summon someone who's not there. But if I was in a house and there was evidence of the house being haunted, I might say, you know, who are you? Are you a soul in purgatory? Do you need prayer?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know.
Right. You didn't conjure them up.
Right. I'm not the one. They're already here. Yeah. I'm just trying to say, why are they here and how do I deal with this? But in terms of these shows now, he mentions electronic voice phenomena. And for people who may not be familiar, what that is, it takes a variety of different forms. But sometimes people will use tape recorders or voice recorders and they'll record room tone. Which is to determine the TV and radio industry. It's you know, just background sounds. And then they'll listen to them in a certain way. They may ramp up the volume. They may apply certain filters. They may run it backwards. It may be like white noise that they're getting from a radio or something, and they put it through this processing. And then people will claim every so often you hear a word or a phrase.
Yeah.
And the conventional explanation for electronic voice phenomena is apophenia. Apophenia is the tendency of humans to find patterns in information where there's really not a pattern there. Like if they're seeing something or perceiving something that's not really there. Like if you're in the jungle and you think you see a tiger lurking in the darkness of the leaves, you're safer to think there's a tiger there than to not.
It's better to have a bias in one direction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so apophenia is the result of this. And I think that apophenia is likely to be, at least under ordinary circumstances, it's the explanation for electronic voice phenomena.
Okay.
Now, I haven't researched it in detail, but that's my impression at this point in time. I plan on looking more into it in the future, but I haven't at this point. So let's suppose that's all that's going on these shows. Is it okay to watch these shows? Well, let's think about what we see on TV normally. Oh, by the way, let's think about in particular the kind of people who make these shows. I think that they could fall in one of a few categories.
Okay.
Number one, they're true believers and they think they're really getting this information.
Yes.
Number two, they're totally cynical and they're just doing it for the money and they don't believe this either.
Right.
And three, they're somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's probably different individuals on these shows. Some of them may be true believers. I suspect a lot of them are totally cynical and just doing it for the money.
Right.
But then there may be some people who are kind of unsure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's think about other people we see on TV. If you tune in to a typical comedy or drama show, are those people on that show that you see playing those parts, are they lying to you?
They are not lying to me.
Right, because you know that this is just fiction.
Yeah.
And so in that case, they're not lying. They're not committing a sin. You're not cooperating with the sin by watching the show. Now let's go to a documentary. In a documentary, are those people under normal circumstances, are the people in the documentary lying to you? I can't speak for everyone, but let's say Richard Attenborough when you're watching
documentary. No, they're trying to tell you the truth. Yeah.
So again, they're not lying. Then, well, what about people who are on wrestling?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
No, they're wrestling.
Well, they're wrestling, but then they come out and they have these, you know, the faces, the good guys, and the heels, the bad guys, and you have face heel turns and heel face turns,
right?
And they have these
all the drama of human life, all the drama of human life.
So
it's beautiful.
So they are, in a sense, putting on a show, but they're not acknowledging it like the actors on a regular show.
Right.
And so it's kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
It is, and I'll actually need to finish this on the other side of the break, but it's kind of in the middle.
Yeah, that's true.
The wrestlers are not taking all the storylines seriously. They know they're fiction, but they're not acknowledging publicly that they're fiction. And so they're in this kind of interesting middle ground. And part of it depends on how much the audience is aware of what's going on.
Right.
So let's talk about that more on the other side of the break.
Okay, it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Love the Weird Questions music. Right back after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Does the church have too many rules? Join me, Dr. David Anders, as we answer your questions right here on Call to Communion, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
There's that theremin.
Ah, yeah, a little bit of theremin for Jimmy. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops every Friday. You can get a new episode today. It's on the Exodus. Did the Exodus really happen? I don't know if I'm paraphrasing. Is that
That's the topic. Did the Exodus happen?
Every now and then.
Tomorrow we record 3 new episodes.
On what do you think? What are you recording on?
We're going to record about a man who went into a coma and visited the 40th century, he said.
Oh, okay.
We're going to talk about psychic testing, and we're going to talk about a ghost that came back and convicted her own killer in court.
Oh, okay. So it's not like a three-parter.
It's three different episodes.
Okay. My brain, I was trying to connect those for a second. But so the guy from the 40th century, I'll just have to wait. I'm just going to wait. I'm not going to ask anything about it. So here's the deal. We have this question from, let me just make sure it's Mike, about watching shows like ghost shows on TV. And you were talking about there's different degrees of kind of fiction and lying.
Yeah. And so the example I was exploring when we had to go to the break was wrestling, because in wrestling, they have these elaborate storylines for the different wrestlers and the characters they play. And they don't let on in public that these are scripted. So they're presenting it as if this is real. And there's actually a word for this in wrestling jargon. I've already used a couple of wrestling terms. Like I mentioned, faces are the good guys. That's short for baby faces because they're supposed to be cute.
Yeah.
And heels, you know, are the bad guys.
I think I'm the face. Are you? Are you the face or the heel?
I think I'm a face too. But
I'll be the heel.
We don't have to be opposed. We could be a team. You know,
oh,
they have wrestling
yes.
teams.
Yeah, we're like okay.
So you have like a face team and a heel team. But then occasionally a face will turn into a heel at a dramatic moment, or a heel will turn into a face. And the general term for keeping all of this secret and projecting the illusion that this is all unscripted and real is kayfabe, which is kind of wrestling pig Latin for fake. Oh. And so you don't break kayfabe by revealing that this is all scripted.
Right.
And so, well, then what does that do with the audience? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people in the audience, being sober adults, well, why, even if they're not ever told it, that this is all scripted, they'll figure it out on their own. You know, it's like when someone's telling you a joke and initially you may not realize it's a joke, but then it becomes obvious.
Right, right.
And that's what happens with a lot of adults watching these things is they watch enough wrestling and it's entertaining, but they know this isn't real.
Yeah.
And kids are a little bit of a different story. Kids, and I remember watching wrestling on TV, you know, back in the South when I was growing up as a kid, and I didn't know it was fake.
I didn't either.
Yeah. Wow. And so, you know, kids don't get this, and that kind of gets you into the Santa Claus issue.
Is that really fair? What is it
okay to tell kids?
Right.
It's not really hurting them to think that it's real, but then they'll grow out of it and realize, oh yeah, that was all pretty improbable, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so that's at least the argument you would make concerning children. So, what about ghost hunters on these shows?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not talking about serious paranormal investigators, but on these kind of ghost hunter entertainment shows. My suspicion is that most of these people are in the kind of wrestler category where they know they're juicing the drama and there's not really likely anything to this particular thing they're investigating. Not that I disbelieve in ghosts. I do. I talked about actual cases.
I do believe in spooks.
Yeah.
I do believe in spooks.
Thank you, Cowardly Lion. but don't make me send the flying monkeys at you. I would think that most of the people on these ghost shows are essentially doing what wrestlers are doing, that they are doing a piece of performance art that is where it's not openly acknowledged that this is very unlikely to be real, but they're aware of it. And a lot of the people in the audience, like Mike, are aware of it.
Yeah.
And so I would say, well, they're either not really trying to deceive people, or if they are, that wouldn't stop me from watching it anyway, because what I'm doing is not wrong. Just watching,
you're just enjoying the show.
I'm just enjoying the show.
Yeah.
The situation is similar to one that Paul discusses in the New Testament, in, for example, 1 Corinthians 8, where he talks about, and Romans 14, where he talks about idol meat. So back in his day, if you went to a meat market, say in Corinth or in Rome, to buy some meat, it had likely been sacrificed to an idol. And then they're reselling it because the god's not really going to eat the meat. And some people felt that they were cooperating in the sin of idolatry, by eating the meat. But Paul's point was, well, if that's what you think, then okay, act on that. Don't violate your conscience. But really, an idol is nothing.
Yeah.
And so so you are not doing anything wrong if you eat the idol meat. And as long as you're aware of the fact that I'm not doing anything wrong by my actions, you could pay for the idol meat.
Yeah.
You could eat the idol meat. It's not a problem. And I would say the same thing is essentially happening here. Even if you think that shows like this, whether it's wrestling or ghost shows or whatever, if you think that that the people on the screen are doing something immoral, you're not. And as long as you're clear that lying is wrong and things like that, then it's not wrong for you to watch it just as entertainment. Where it could be an issue is if you're setting an example for someone else. So let's suppose you've got a small child in the house and you're watching the ghost shows with the small child, and the small child is having night terrors as a result. Well, then maybe you don't want to watch the ghost shows.
Yeah.
Or you've got a child who's attributing too much significance to them. Then you want to make it clear that, okay, this show isn't for real. Maybe you want to watch it after the child's gone to bed, or maybe you want to have a talk with the child to make sure they understand this isn't really real. This is just for fun.
Right.
They're just pretending on the TV.
Yeah.
But as long as you take care of the necessary concerns like that, I don't see a problem with watching them just for entertainment.
What about watching the TV news with people who think that it's real?
Well, I would say the same essential principles apply. Yeah. And I'm serious about that, because lots of TV news is totally staged.
It's just silliness, a lot of it.
And that's across all networks. I don't care what network you name, even if it's your favorite, a lot of it is staged.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've seen it myself. You know, you go down to report on something and there's a crowd of 11 people and the cameraman gets in the midst of the crowd, mm-hmm. you know, because you stand back 10 feet and you would say, this is not even worth reporting on.
But there's that famous YouTube clip of it's flooding here in downtown wherever.
Right. And people are jogging
behind him. And people are jogging behind him over the supposed flood.
Yeah. I'm glad we connected on that one. Because. All right, let's go to Kyle's question. All right, it's weird questions with Jimmy Egan, by the way. That's why we're asking these questions. And Kyle asked this. Let's say, in an alternate timeline, the Left Behind fictional series centered around the end of the world and the second coming of Christ was authored by faithful Catholics. In order to keep the series in line with church teaching, what events would need to be included, what events would need to be omitted, and what events may or may not be included as they are subject to theological speculation?
Well, a lot of events are subject to theological speculation. The church does not have a detailed teaching on exactly what's going to happen at the end of the world. The big change that would have to occur is that the Left Behind series is a set of books written by evangelicals, and not just any evangelicals, but specifically evangelicals who believe in a view called dispensationalism. And according to dispensationalism, the next major event in God's prophetic calendar is Jesus is going to come down and snatch away all of the believers, all the people who believe in him, and that's an event called the rapture. And then all hell's going to break loose on Earth for a period of time, typically 7 years, and the Antichrist is going to arrive, and there's going to be stuff going on with the state of Israel, and a temple will be rebuilt in Israel, and then eventually Jesus will return at the true second coming and kill the Antichrist and reign in Jerusalem for 1,000 years before there's another crisis before the real end of the world. Okay, so the Left Behind novels, I gather, go up to the beginning of the millennium, and then they kind of stop. At least that's my understanding.
Okay.
Because it's kind of hard to write 1,000 years with Jesus reigning in Jerusalem and stuff's great, you know.
boring novel.
Yeah. So in a Catholic equivalent of this, we would not be building up to the millennium, because the millennium is occurring right now spiritually. There will not be, according to Catholic teaching, after the second coming, a 1,000-year period where Jesus reigns on earth and they're doing animal sacrifices in the temple in Jerusalem and stuff like that. So the millennium would not be the end point. Instead, the end point would be the second coming, at which Jesus will return and gather the people to be with him. So that's when the rapture occurs, is at the true second coming, not a period of time before that. And then the dead are raised and judged, and the world ends. So that would be the terminus of a Catholic equivalent. The church then, since there's no early rapture to take the church out of the way, that means we get to live through the time when the Antichrist is around and causing problems. There might or might not be a new temple in Jerusalem, and the state of Israel may or may not be involved. All of that's open to theological speculation. The church does teach that there will be a notable conversion of Jewish people to Christ before the second coming, shortly before the second coming. So that would presumably be an element in these novels, but it wouldn't involve the getting believers taken away at the beginning. Much of the rest of it might play out the same, but it'll end with the true second coming and the resurrection of the dead rather than a millennium.
And people have written those novels.
There are Catholic equivalents.
Father Elijah, an apocalypse.
Well, I was thinking of Lord of the World.
Oh, yes, Lord of the World, right. Mm-hmm. Oh, a great book. Yeah, from, it's so, I love Lord of the World, too, just to see a kind of like, I think it was written in 1907, mm-hmm. a 1907 version of the future. It's kind of fun to see.
Oh, those are a lot of fun. Yeah. I've been surprised reading science fiction from that age, how they like expected us to have suicide booths all over the place.
I know. It's good. Yeah. It's weird. But they didn't get the jet airplane, or at least the writer of Lord of the World didn't. They were like really fast dirigibles.
Oh, yeah.
I think fast was 100 miles an hour. Uh-huh. You know, you're like all the way up to 100 miles an hour.
It's impressive for a dirigible.
Yeah, that is right. We better take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
One of the more popular items on the RC show this month, as we celebrate EWTN's founding, is the Our Lady of the Angels Chapel Triptych. Inside is a beautiful image of the chapel sanctuary, along with the prayer Mother Angelica prayed as she began her holy hour of adoration each day, a tradition of the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration that continues today. The Our Lady of the Angels Chapel Triptych. To order, go to EWTNRC.com and search for item number TE1.
Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Great week here at Catholic Answers. Thanks for all your support this week. And we're wrapping up Friday or starting Saturday morning, depending where you are, with fun stuff. Yeah. And this next one comes from Paul, and it starts with, by the way, if you want to write a question for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, this first sentence is like the classic first sentence. Suppose someone became an undead vampire. That's the way to start a weird question. Suppose someone became...
I like it because it doesn't give us the prehistory of the question. It's like, so I was laying in bed the other night and I was watching this movie and I was talking with my wife and the movie happened. It didn't really have vampires, but it sort of had zombies that were kind of like vampires. And so that made me wonder. And then I had this dream and it's like, no, just... Suppose someone became an undead vampire.
Yet, they still have a moral conscience and no right from wrong. The church also teaches that suicide is a mortal sin. Would it be a sin for such a person to commit suicide in order to protect others from becoming vampires?
Okay, so in this scenario, if the vampire feeds on another person, that person becomes a vampire.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are several plot twists to this question. The first one is right there in that first classic sentence. Suppose someone became an undead vampire. Well, okay, if they're an undead vampire, if they've really died, there's an argument they're really dead. They're just an animated body walking around somehow. But they aren't a living person with a right to life. And so maybe just ending your own existence in this case would not be suicide.
No.
Because you're already dead.
Yeah.
But suppose that's not the case. Suppose that they are a being with a right to life. Okay, next question. They have this moral conscience. They know right from wrong. And before we get to the point of considering suicide, we want to consider, are there lesser things that they could do?
Right.
Are there other ways out of the situation? Like if they if they need hemoglobin to survive, how about animal blood?
Right.
You know, maybe they could just eat a lot of blood pudding or black pudding, which is a kind of blood sausage, or, you know, otherwise acquire animal blood and take care of their need that way, in which case you don't even have to bring humans into the picture. You just get animal blood. You can get it. It's not used in American cuisine, but it is used in some world cuisines, and you can go to the right kind of store and get it. But let's suppose that's not the case. Let's suppose it has to be human blood. Okay. something about the antigens or something.
No.
Well, okay, in that case, do you have to bite people to get human blood?
Just go to the blood bank.
You could go to the blood
bank.
Make a withdrawal. You could, that's the classic joke, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember reading that in a little book of monster cartoons when I was 7 years old. And you could either use a blood bank or you could have friends or family who can serve as donors. Thing is, you don't have to even, you know, so let's say it's a little hard to explain to the people at the blood bank why you need the blood because they're not really buying the I'm a vampire thing. Well, right. You could get a private donor network. You could also pay people. Start your own blood bank effectively, although that might get you in trouble with the health department.
That's the least of your problems. You're an undead vampire.
Yeah, they just come over. They come over to investigate you. You just hypnotize them, and they go away.
Right, exactly.
It doesn't appear that you have to bite people in order to do this. But to get to the core of the question, which is what we're doing, let's suppose you do. You know, let's suppose that you do have to bite people. The blood has to come through your fangs or whatever. Well, in that case, there would be another option before suicide, starvation.
Uh-huh.
Because if you starve to death because you can't ethically acquire food, that is not suicide.
No.
You know, let's suppose I'm in the desert and I've got a small child with me and there's only enough food to keep one of us alive. And I have no other sources of food. If I give the food to the child and I end up starving to death as a result because I can't ethically get food elsewhere, then I'm not committing suicide.
No.
And so so starving yourself would be an acceptable alternative to turning other people into vampires. Well, let's suppose that's not going to work because we're still edging our way towards the core of the question. I mean, I'm pointing out all these things here.
None of this will work.
So suppose that starvation won't work because at some point I'm going to lose control of myself. It's like my vampire instincts will kick in and I will attack someone.
Yeah.
Okay. The next strategy short of suicide would be disable yourself so that when the vampire instincts kick in, you're not able to hurt anybody. You lock yourself in a room. Maybe you put mirrors all around yourself.
Oh, like the werewolf. You used to chain himself to a wall.
I was just going
to
cite that. You chain yourself to a wall. You put on a shock collar. You tranquilize yourself. Whatever you need to do, you disable yourself so that when the bloodlust comes upon you, you're not able to act on it.
Right.
Okay. Suppose none of that's going to work because you're Kronos, the original vampire, and
just too powerful.
You're just too powerful. Okay. So there's no way to stop yourself other than dying. Well, you could ask someone else to kill you, stake you. That, though, would be suicide because you're cooperating with it, you're willing it. It would be formal cooperation. If it's actually suicide. And here we're at the core of the question, because suicide is not just any act that results in your own death. You can legitimately do things to save other people's lives, like jump on a grenade.
Oh, right, right.
You know, that's not suicide. That's legitimate. If you happen to survive, that would be great.
Yeah.
You're just foreseeing that you're not. Now, the tricky part is the fact, in this case, you would be willing the death of your current body.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see a scenario where there's at least an argument that you would not, that it wouldn't count as suicide as it's normally understood. Because as it's normally understood, your suicide involves killing an innocent person, someone who is not an aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are a person who foresees, I will inevitably, uncontrollably become an aggressor, and I have no choice about that, then just like I could, like, let's say I knew that someone else other than me was inevitably going to launch a lethal attack, I could kill that person at least once they've launched the attack.
Yeah.
I could kill that person. And I could take steps to launch the attack once they begin it. Like I set up a shotgun trap or something so they open the door to come into the room to get me,
yeah.
and the shotgun will take them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's legitimate. I'm killing a person who is at the moment an aggressor, and this is the only or best way to stop them. Well, what if I foresee I will inevitably become that person?
Right.
It seems to me there's an argument that it would not be suicide, but would be legitimate defense of others for me to do the same thing. So that I, say, set up the shotgun trap so that when I open the door to go out and start feeding on people, I will be blown away and thus will protect others. Yeah. And that would not arguably have the moral character of suicide. It would instead have the moral character of stopping an aggressor, because in the moment I'm killed, I would actually be an aggressor.
I think the obvious, easy solution is don't become an undead vampire. I mean, start there.
Hey, I got to roll with the premises I'm
yeah,
given.
Yeah, exactly right. A different Paul asks this. Thank you, Paul, for that question, and thank you for the excellent opening sentence. How would you reconcile Earth's liturgical calendar with planets that have longer or shorter solar years? Can you have Easter twice in one year? Could you have a year without Christmas?
So I think that the answer to this is going to be upon us very quickly.
Yeah, because people are going to be living on other planets.
Exactly. And as long as the people are living in the solar system, my sense is they're going to keep their calendars tied to the calendar of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be a little bit of adjustment, in particular in the case of Mars, because Mars's day is not exactly what an Earth day is, but it's close enough. You could do a little fudging to keep them in sync. So you might have a little variation, but in terms of the big holidays like Easter and Christmas, people on Mars are going to be celebrating that at the same time people are celebrating it on Earth.
Right.
Anywhere in the solar, like they do on the International Space Station. You know,
yeah,
they're not
right.
on Earth, but they celebrate Christmas at the time people on Earth are. Same thing is going to happen all the way through the solar system. And that means that if we have people on some planets, you will have years where there are either multiple Christmases and Easters or not a Christmas and Easter. On Mercury, for example, Mercury is close to the sun. It orbits the sun every 88 days. And that means in a given year for Mercury, because the Mercurian years are so short, you probably will not have a Christmas or Easter. It will take, you'll still have one every 365 Earth days.
Right.
But in Mercurian years, that'll be every 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Every 4 to 5 Mercury years, you'll have a Christmas or an Easter. Mars, on the other hand. Now, Mars has an orbit of 687 days, which is almost 2 Earth years.
Mm-hmm.
So every 365 Earth days, you'll have a Christmas and Easter. But in Mars years, you will sometimes have one Christmas and Easter in a Mars year, but sometimes you will have 2 Christmas and Easters in a Mars year. When it comes to Jupiter, it's got a 12-year orbit. You're going to have 12 Christmases
years.
And Easters every year.
Yeah.
Saturn, you're going to have 60. And so but I think as long as we're in the solar system, we're basically going to be using Earth's liturgical calendar with some adjustments, like in the case of Mars, where the day is so close to Earth's.
Yeah.
If we get out of the solar system and we're dealing with very distant places, I suspect that they will develop their own liturgical calendars based around the orbits of their planets, but there will probably be some attempt to keep Christmas and Easter universal for everybody.
Hey, thanks, Second Paul, for that question. That was a great one. Thanks, Jimmy, for 2 very fine hours.
My pleasure.
I leave this with my conviction that you should not become an undead vampire strengthened.
I will endeavor not to.
Okay, very, very good. Once again, I want to thank everybody who supported us this week with your prayers and your financial support. It really was an astonishing day yesterday and an astonishing week, and one we're very, very grateful for and won't forget anytime soon. We're going to, well, that does it for us, actually. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.